This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Welcome to Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, based here in Christchurch. Today's topic is women in the workplace. We're going to be thinking about various different things, pay equity, the women's empowerment principles, all sorts of things. And we've got three exciting guests with us today. If you could please just kick it off, Jackie.
Hi, I'm Jackie Blue. I work for the Human Rights Commission. I'm the Equal Employment Opportunities Commissioner. I'm also part of our WEPS committee, but I'll let Angela talk about that later on.
And maybe just to clarify, WEPS is the Women's Empowerment Principle.
Exactly, yeah.
Good morning, I'm Erin Ebourne, and I'm the Director of Ebourne Law Limited. We are a family law firm that specialises in legal aid and family court work, and Ebourne Law Limited is a signatory to the Women's Empowerment Principles.
Very cool. And Angela?
Great, kia ora. I'm Angela McLeod. I'm Vice President of the UN Women National Committee Aotearoa New Zealand and the UN Women International and UN Global Compact are the initiators of the Women's Empowerment Principles.
And Angela, could you just let us know, how does UN Women Aotearoa fit in within the international UN Women?
Oh, great question. So UN Women is in New Zealand, if I can just shorten it because it's a bit of a mouthful, is that we are an autonomous group. So UN Women based in New York has what they call national committees worldwide. So pretty much there's quite a few. You know, Australia has one, Japan, Norway, you know, across the world. And they essentially, our mandate, if I use our as in all of the national committees, our mandates are to raise money to empower women through projects in our area. In New Zealand, our area is the Pacific. So all of the projects that we do here to empower women in some way in the Pacific.
Very cool. And I guess to start our conversation today, why is the topic women in the workplace important? And why is it important in 2016?
I'll kick off, I think, Sally. The Human Rights Commission has done a lot of work in labour market metrics and how women fare, and it's all online as our Tracking Equality at Work tool. But basically, when you look at the tool and you go through the various metrics and you can filter by age, sex and ethnicity, women are marginalised. They do worse in every level on pay, on employment, and labour force participation. And when you drill down even further, it's not just women, it's young Māori and Pacific women who are particularly disadvantaged. Women are not doing well in the labour market.
Mm. So if I could just jump in here to add to that, and one of the things that I didn't quite say before is UN Women also, national committees, have a role in highlighting and advocating for gender equality and economic empowerment of women. And I think the important thing for us also to understand is that the statistics that the Human Rights Commission have found is great because we also have research, and there's international research and New Zealand research to say that if you empower women in the workplace, in economically and socially, your bottom line improves.
Yeah.
It makes economic sense.
Absolutely, and I'll add on to that. I think business is in a powerful position to create positive social change by gender equality in the workplace and having respectful relationship and transparency and fair practices, etc. Those dynamics can spill over into wider society. So there's no question business is in the box seat to do really good stuff.
My background is obviously within the legal profession, and it's been a situation where, because women have come through into the profession a bit later, that we've been told to wait, and that if we get more women graduates, then eventually they'll work their way up through the ranks and we'll begin to have more women judges and more women partners or directors of law firms. Whereas we've had equal, if not more, than women graduates from law schools for decades now, and we're still seeing a situation where only 24% of partners in law firms, 15% of Queen's Counsel and 29% of judges are women. And the trickle-up effect of waiting isn't working, and we need to be more active. And that's where I see the women's empowerment principles as playing a role in ensuring that we have a commitment to seeing women in the workforce being progressed.
Do you, Erin, do you find that women, do you think, well, they're not seen, they're getting promoted and they're striving for getting higher and higher up the ladder, but they're not getting it, they're leaving the profession? Is that a problem you've noticed?
It is a problem. There was actually a great article in Law Talk, which is the New Zealand Law Society magazine, on women in the profession last year. And it's more than just speculation. It's clear that women aren't actually staying in the profession and are leaving, in part because of the expectations of the hours, the focus on billable work, and the inflexibility. Sometimes that comes alongside with the culture of a law firm. So it's not a career that's remained attractive to women, which is a loss, of course, to the profession.
I mean, demographically, we are an ageing population, and the fact is we are right here and now, we need to retain all our talented workers, all workers for that matter. We can't afford to let them go and lose those skills. We are in a situation where we're going to have to bring migrant labour in to sustain our economy going forward, and it's happening right now. So it's really dumb for businesses to let staff go who they have, and they have to go through that whole retraining exercise, and it costs money, etc. So it makes sense, as Angela was saying, that businesses need to step up and create a workplace, an environment that's great to work in, where there is gender equality, where people are treated equally, and there's transparency and fair practices and so forth.
It's also just the right thing to do, because we have a lot of, I think, a shift in language around when we're talking about women and work to being a business-focused argument, which is a powerful argument, but also we need to keep alongside that a values-based argument as well, around the fact that we need to be having a society which is inclusive, and where there are barriers to participation, looking at addressing those barriers, because people should be entitled, irrespective of gender or their ability or disability or ethnicity, to participate in the workforce to the fullest of the extent that they are able to do so. So I still like to see discussions around inequality and injustice and what creates exclusion as well as inclusion, as well as the important points that you're raising around an economic requirement to have equal to good participation.
I mean, there was a study done in 2011 by Goldman Sachs, and and they looked at New Zealand businesses, and made the statement that if we could increase participation of women in our labour market, and you know, I presented a graph today which showed that women are way behind men's participation, particularly Māori and Pacific women are even worse. If we could increase our participation, our economy could our GDP could increase by 10%. Now that's huge economic a plus.
It is, Jackie. But also, what needs to happen, because I've noticed that that there has been an increase of women in the labour market, but the gender pay gap. So unless there's some work or some movement in that as well, I mean, the gender pay gap is only one issue in the workplace, of course, but it is just one that's been measured for some time now, and one which we could change, then that whole combination of increasing women in the workforce and fixing that gender pay gap, as the saying goes, Bob's your uncle. I mean, I don't like it, but I mean, that's, from an economic sense, that would be part of it. But also, Erin, I've got a question for you too. Is some of the problem with, you know, women in the law law practices, do they come back to work after, you know, spending time at home with family?
I don't probably know the answer to that. But I think, if I recall what the information I've seen previously, is that no, it's not actually a matter of that women are leaving because they're leaving to have a family and they're not returning. It's a matter that women are rejecting the profession as a career choice because of, to an extent, the way that it operates,
the culture,
culture of it. And that it's not gelling with the values of this generation.
The gender pay gap that Angela raised is very important, and it is a very high level measure that we use to measure inequality between men and women in our labour market, and it has really stagnated. It got actually slightly worse last year. But I would, and one of the things that the WEPS principles does cover is greater gender pay equity, in other words, making sure women are paid fairly and doing regular audits and checks. And in the strategy document, which we launched this morning, is actually, it's a great document. It's modern, it's up to date, it's in plain English. It gives people, it's not just rhetoric, it gives businesses practical things they can do to address things like the gender pay gap. Yeah, and so I personally think I would love to see, this is not WEPS policy, but my particular passion is I would like to see companies over 250 employees publish their pay gender gaps publicly. This is what's going to happen in the United Kingdom next year. It's already happening in Australia with companies over 100 employees. And I think it's a powerful motivator for change once you publicise this sort of data.
It's the idea of naming and shaming.
Exactly. And I think businesses are usually pretty competitive in New Zealand. And once they see some good role models and they can see themselves having a wide gap, they'll want to actually make positive change so they can reduce that gap. And having it publicised and knowing whether it's big, small or indifferent means that they can start drilling down why it's like that. And I think one of the hugest factors of it is actually women taking career breaks, coming back, and their career trajectory just, you know, falls away. And I think that's a key area. Women returning to the workforce is a huge factor in the widening gender pay gap.
And also, Erin, to back up, you know, the work that you're doing, you know, by being a signatory to the Women's Empowerment Principles, is that the what I see is that the gender norm and the structures of the workplace need to change, like you're suggesting. You know, the culture needs to change, and I think the Women's Empowerment Principles is a really good roadmap or a good guideline for businesses to be able to do that.
I agree with that, and we need to be acknowledging that it's a systemic issue, and it's not a matter of only having women in visible positions and mentoring and leadership, but also that there needs to be actual action taken to ensure that the barriers to women's participation in the workforce are addressed, because we can't just sit and do nothing or say it's a matter of role modelling and aspiration as opposed to actually taking clear steps and making clear commitments and setting targets and reporting and praising as well when that occurs.
Agreed.
Well, that seems like a good place to have our first break. Erin, you've chosen a song for us, Bread and Roses. Was there a reason for that?
I love the song. I think it's inspiring, but also because it highlights in it as well that the advancement of women is not just about our advancement, but also the advancement of men alongside us as well as a partnership.
Put your hat on, honey. You can ask Mimi to come and sing Bread and Roses with me.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts grey, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women means the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler tend that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Mai hoki mai. Welcome back to Speak Up Kōrerotia. We're speaking with Jackie Blue, Erin Evon and Angela McLeod about women in the workplace. We're going to kick off this segment thinking about why on earth are we still having to discuss women's rights in 2016?
Yeah, New Zealand's been applauded and noted and paraded around as being the first country to give women the vote. But the fact is we've dined out on that far too long. We have issues of gender representation and leadership. We have huge, terrible violence against women's stats. We don't have gender equity in pay. So we're still fighting the fight, you know, from the feminists were fighting back in the 70s, let alone way back in Kate Shepherd's day. So we've, you know, it's appalling that we still only have 30% women in parliament and so forth. It's terrible.
And I think for me too, is that there's actually a lack of leadership in it. So the priorities aren't conducive to the empowerment of women. So for instance, you know, the Sherwin report about the foreign tax havens. You know, he was asked to do that report in April. I think he reported back in something like June, and the government's taken on the recommendations. Crikey. The Joint Working Group on Pay Equity was put together last year. They were a month late in getting their reports out and were still waiting, for a response from the government. I think in not only have we been, you know, sitting on our laurels around that whole, you know, first country in the world or first nation in the world to give women the vote, you know, we just don't have leadership in that space either.
It's also about making it relevant to young women today, because it disheartens me when I hear people say, I'm not a feminist, but, and then go on to say something which is naturally feminist, as though feminism is an F word that we shouldn't be talking about anymore, or that the job was done and that was something that, you know, women did back in the 70s, and didn't they burn their bras or something like that? Mm. You know, and actually, no, I don't think they did in New Zealand ever. but to make sure that we're bringing in that generation with us, and the statistics that Jackie was talking about are really appalling, and they're unjustifiable from the economic sense that she's talking about and from a human rights sense.
Mm. Yeah, the Angela mentioned about the Joint Working Group recommendations on labour pay equity principles across the labour market. They've come out with recommendations which I think have been supported by everyone, and it's tantalisingly close that we could have a mechanism to get pay equity where jobs are revalued. The women's jobs are typically undervalued, underpaid, and seen as women's work, where they can be revalued as far as work, effort and skill goes. And that is going to be huge when it comes. And I believe it will come. I'm an optimist. I hope it can't happen soon enough, quite frankly.
One thing that strikes me when we're talking about women's rights today particularly, I mean, this the sort of era that we're talking in, is how do these, or the idea of women's rights, sit along LGBTQI rights, which is such a strong movement at the moment and really challenging this idea of a gender binary?
Hmm. my thoughts on that, and it also goes with ethnic diversity when we're talking about, you know, on boards and things like that. For me, it's about, actually, what my concern is, we can't get gender right. So how can we get, you know, any other thing right when we can't, and we've had women voting since the 1890s. We haven't got it right. How are we going to get the rest right?
I think feminism has long critiqued the construct of gender.
Yeah.
And that's basically the essence of feminism itself, is how gender is a social construct, and then how that construct constrains particular sectors of society from advancing or participating. So I don't see women's rights or feminist theory at all contrary to the advancements of the queer arguments around non-binary perspectives. They're not at odds with each other. And when we're talking about rights, there isn't a limited amount of rights where if one portion of society gets some certain rights, that another portion of society somehow or other miraculously ends up with less. It's not a pie to divide up. And so I can see that the two trains of thought can actually intersect with each other.
It's about everyone's human rights. I think at the end of the day, we all have equal human rights, no matter who we are or how we define ourselves. The fact is, LGBTI groups, along with disabled groups, Māori and Pacific groups, young people, are all marginalised in the workforce and have vulnerabilities in, unique to some of those groups. And that's not right. And that's what we have to address.
So again, it comes back to ensuring that what we're doing is flexible so that we're not being exclusive in what we're doing, and the original values of equity, justice and inclusiveness.
That sounds great. Now, thinking about those, what are sectors in which women are performing well, or which are, I guess, a good representation of women? We've spoken about the legal sector, but what other sectors are there?
They're doing well professionally. More and more women are graduating with tertiary education. But the professions they're going into typically are nursing or teaching, as opposed to engineering and other areas, which don't pay as well. So that's in part also the pay gender gap. Women are dominating areas that are not well paid. They're dominating the caring, the clerical, the admin, and the cleaning sectors, not well paid at all.
Yeah, traditional women's work. See, it's back to what Jackie said before about not valuing women's work. But what's also really interesting is that the women that are doing, you know, their engineering degrees and all that sort of thing alongside their male counterparts, and within their first year out into the workplace, you know, the pay gap is 6 to 8%, and and that's nothing to do with anything else except, well, as far as we can tell, you know, anything else except, I don't know, they're just women in the engineering field that are paid less than the male that came out of university the same time as them.
And even a small gap at the start of a career just widens in a crazy way after several years. It just keeps blowing out.
Do we have a sense of why there's that pay gap, particularly at those initial years?
I think it's difficult to know what to ask for sometimes. When you're starting off as a graduate, people don't talk about salaries generally. So I think it's difficult to know where to pitch yourself. And so if you were entering an individual negotiation, then if you don't know even where to start or what to ask for or how to value what you're worth, then you're going to start off at a lower footing in the first place. Whereas if we know more around what different salaries are for different positions and different comparisons, then you've got a more informed background to start with.
Mm. And also there's anecdotal, I've got anecdotal, you know, evidence that often the goalposts aren't the same. So even though you're not sure of your value when you first come out of university, also there's, you know, women and men can be offered a different salary range. When you talk about a salary range, you know, a man will be told that it's 50 to 60,000 and a woman will be told it's 40 to 50. So, you know, there's that as well, and that's where this whole changing the construct or the norms within the workplace is important.
I showed a graph this morning from the State Service Commission. They have 46,000 employees, and it showed that even in the early 20s when careers were starting, there was a pay gender gap of about 2%. And I'm sure they would advertise jobs saying we're in this salary band, A, B, C or D, so a person going for that job would know that they're in this, going to be in this band. But clearly women are settling for the lower part of the band, not the upper part of the band. That's my interpretation of it.
And the information you're presenting was showing a much better outcomes within the state sector as well than in the private sector. So I think that's where, if you're making a commitment to women's empowerment principles, it's also about ensuring that you're reviewing salaries on a regular basis and making sure that what is being provided is within a market norm, and that you are actively giving employees salary increases rather than waiting for them to ask.
Exactly, and that's what a good employer does. And clearly, Erin, I've read your story, you are a great employer. No, truly, creating a great... She has to kick her employees out on a Friday because they want to stay late. No, truly, and she's got talented, committed, passionate, loyal staff as a result of the workplace she's created.
They are fantastic staff.
And see, that's good for productivity, isn't it? Across the board.
It is, but I would still like them to go home a bit earlier.
Oh, yeah.
And relax a bit more.
Yeah.
It does go to show, that. Doesn't it? If you treat people well, they want to give more back, though.
No question about it. Decent work, decent pay, decent conditions pays off in all ways, all levels.
It absolutely does. And one of the practices as well that the Law Society is promoting is the principle of practicing well with healthy mind, healthy body and healthy business practice. Because the profession has been one that's been often high stress, very prone to alcohol misuse or depression. And so there needs to be that shift around how we treat our staff and creating that space for flexibility as well to be able to ensure that I think that would help engage and retain women in the profession as well because of that flexibility and the ability to balance better between the expectations of the role.
Well, that might be time for our next break, and Jackie, we've got your song.
My song is I Am Woman by Helen Reddy, and I've chosen that because women are powerful. We're half the world's population, actually 51% of the world's population, and we're part of the solution, not part of the problem. And we need to bring women through, empower our young girls, empower our women. And I tell you, countries, societies will prosper. And with women in charge, equally in charge, we would have world peace. Women do not want war, they want peace. We need women at our front lines negotiating peace settlements, not a bunch of men.
Awesome, here we go.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend, 'cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Oh, yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong,
strong.
I am invincible,
invincible.
It only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, 'cause you've deepened the conviction in my soul. Oh, yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I pay the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to,
Speak Up Cord Energy here on Plains FM 96.9. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, and we're with Jackie Blue, Erin Ebon, and Angela McLeod, talking about women in the workplace. To kick off this section, we're going to be thinking about some of the factors that are less equitable, and in this place we've got particularly ethnicity and disability, and also some of the factors that can be put in place to try and increase equity, including around gender.
Well, to kick off with disability, it is a huge area of concern. I mean, there's a lot of groups that are marginalised in the workplace, but disabled people are the worst. They truly are. And one of the problems is we don't have enough data. That's only collected after every census. That's every 5 years. So that is a problem in itself. And no one's collecting the data in the workplace. The public service through the State Service Commission has made a promise that they are going to start doing this, and they're going to start collecting data, and they set up a working group to look at definitions, because that's a problem. What's the definition of disability? Your disability is not my disability, I don't identify it, and so forth. So they've done that, and they have also brought out a toolkit for employers who have disabled employees. And that's a huge loss of potential. I think 50% of the disability people in the working age disability group are actually in work, and there's a heap of people that would want work and are trying to find work but can't get it. So that is a problem, and it's going to be focused as part of my work going forward. It needs more focus. We've had some great success though here. I'll talk about Project 300 in Christchurch. They took 300 people off the benefit who were on a sickness, or the old sickness or invalids benefit, and they got WorkBridge in to assess them. They went into employers and said, "We want you to open up some spaces for people with a disability." This is one of the criteria. They're on a benefit and they had a disability. And so they chose 300 of them, and they got employers to make up vacancies, and MSD helped with funding new services or changing the environment so it would suit. So, you know, and they got a huge number into work, and it's been sustained work, and that is astonishing. So it can be done, and it's good to have diversity in the workplace. Everyone brings different things to work, and people with disability bring the whole different perspective. So I want to make a plug for disability and employees, you know, and the fact they're so marginalised. But even in disability, there's even greater prejudice and discrimination at people with a mental illness, because that's invisible. People who can understand a wheelchair, or, you know, people who have visual impairment, that's different. But the invisible disabilities are a real concern, and they suffer even worse discrimination. But there has been a great project in Christchurch, and it needs to be applauded. I think they're rolling it out in other centres.
There's also been some concern at the UN. There's the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, which is what we call it, quickly, the acronym. So CEDAW has identified that, there is disabled women are doubly discriminated, and so they've got some recommendations around what the state party or the countries can do to eliminate that. But I have personal experience with that, because I was involved with a car accident, and so physically there's some things that I struggle with, because, you know, my biomechanics have changed with that. And what was really interesting is that when I was trying to get back into the workforce after 5 years of doing rehab and part-time work, it was actually really hard. You had to be careful, because there was an honesty that you needed to be about, that actually I need to be on the special assistance list in an evacuation or a stressful situation, and people automatically think the worst. And I think that it took a long while, some really good support from the ACC case manager and some other people, you know, and actually getting out and actually, you know, getting in front of some of the agencies. Essentially, it was actually personal contact that got me back into the workforce, and people, you know, that I've been talking to. But I think that it's a real issue, and at least the UN CEDAW committee have identified it, and they've identified it for New Zealand. And I know that there's been a lot of work done on it, and especially with the other convention that's the, you know, on the rights with people with disabilities, persons with disabilities, that, you know, there's some work happening in that space.
And for pre-employment, there's a real damned if you do, damned if you don't disclose that you have a disability. Damned if you do, you might not get the job because they feel that wouldn't be able to cope. And and if you don't disclose and later on it becomes evident, you didn't disclose it at the interview, and that's, you know, a concern. So really real issues with employing people with disabilities.
And what are some of the policies and practices that you've seen that are helping to empower women in the workplace with disabilities or not?
Well, I think you have pockets. Well, I know the ZEnergy have made a real focus of employing people with disability. They've made it one of their focal points, and I applaud them for that. But I don't think otherwise. I mean, companies aren't collecting data on people with disabilities. That's, you know, that's the last thing that they'll even think about. They're getting used to the idea of, you know, yeah, we need to promote women, we need to have greater diversity, we need to bring women through, etc. But people with disability, it's not getting any focus at the moment. So I can't really say there's any practices happening because it's not really a big thing in the workplace at the moment.
Yeah, and that's a shame. And I think that it's a real shame.
What are your perspectives on quotas or targets or aspirations in terms of gender equity and, I suppose, other elements of diversity as well, but particularly in terms of gender?
Good question. I'll kick off and I'm sure it'll create conversation. Our women on boards in the private sector and senior management teams, pathetic. We have women in private sector senior management teams in New Zealand are about 19-20%. We've fallen from about 30%. 20% women on senior management teams in New Zealand businesses, that's dreadful. It's appalling. Women on private boards through stock exchange listed companies, we're tracking at 17%, improved by about 5% over the last 3 years. It's still going to take 15 years before we get 50%. Women in Parliament, 30%. And we've been like that for the last 18 or so years. You know, just can go on and on and on. Is it going to happen by natural osmosis? It doesn't look like it is. So, yeah, Norway has got 40% women on their boards, and they've done it through a quota law. And it said to their businesses, if you don't have 40% women on your boards, we're going to dissolve you. And guess what? There was a massive improvement from about 9% to 40% overnight, virtually. We need quotas. And that's going to be controversial, but I think the time is for quotas. Let's have that debate.
Yeah, and, you know, I agree. And it's interesting because the CEDAW committee for years has been saying, and instead of saying quotas, you could use temporary special measures. And if somebody ever turns around and says, oh, we don't, you know, because there's this kind of fear of using the term mandatory or quota or temporary special measures, they do it all the time in a drought, for goodness sake. You know, so it's not like it's not undoable. It's like whenever, you know, the government puts up money, councils put up money for certain things that, oh, there's an emergency, there's a temporary special measure. We're going to put $500,000 towards, you know, the farmers of South Canterbury. Not that we shouldn't be doing that, please don't get me wrong, but we can do it as a country for other things. And it goes back to my original thing around priorities, that the priorities aren't there for that support for such a movement as quota or temporary special measures. And the really interesting thing about the Norway model that Jackie was just mentioning is that Arne Hoel, who was the minister involved in that, and I think it's called Gender Equality and Children or something, the ministry, she was saying that their legislation is actually about the underrepresented gender. Of course, it was mostly that women were underrepresented, but on boards where it was underrepresented in men, the minimum has to be 40%. So it goes both ways. Mm. And there's a huge shift happened when they also included compulsory paid parental leave for men.
Mm.
So then that changed, and then so did that whole, you know, women on boards. It was brilliant, and I agree with you entirely, Jackie.
So what you get then when you have a quota is a cultural shift.
Yeah.
And that's the avenue to at least affect that change, because once you change that culture around the board table, then you're more likely then to be able to sustain the diversity around the board.
Yeah. It's basically disrupting the norm, and women aren't necessarily seen as leaders, and you bring them through as leaders, and then they are seen as leaders, and then you change the culture, and you can take away the temporary special measure because it will happen naturally, but you need that to force the change to begin with.
What I find offensive when people talk about quotas is the suggestion that by doing so, you're only going to get really average women on the board.
Yeah, that bends me too.
As if there's not this amazing pool of talented women, and that the women, for some reason, aren't as good as the men who are already on the board, and that by removing one male off the board, you're going to somehow end up with someone who's less competent. And I find that appalling. But that's one of the arguments that often seems to be raised when you talk about quotas, is that, oh, we're going to have people who are inadequate or who are only there because of a gender, and it's just so untrue.
Well, we don't believe in quotas. We choose on merit.
I mean, there aren't
enough good women out there. Well, who defines what merit is? It's usually the boys define what merit is, and it's boys choosing boys, and that's this closed loop going around talking to each other how fantastic they are.
And I'm all for meritocracy if it's clinical, if it's, like this list of skill sets that you tick off, but it isn't. It never is. It's got values and behaviours and all those comfort things. And being able to play golf on a Friday afternoon, it's just ridiculous.
Sometimes just for fun, I say, wouldn't it be amazing if Parliament was 70% women and only 30% men? And you get these horrified looks around the table, and then people go, but that's not fair. And you go, yeah, I know, it's not, is it?
And then there's research to suggest, and I haven't been able to lay my finger on it, but I quoted a lot, which is probably not that good. But there is research to suggest that in a room of people, when there are about 17% women, the men think it's 30%, and when there's 33% women, they think it's a takeover and it's over 50%. You know, there's this whole perception thing that we have to deal with. Go on.
And that the women who are in these positions, who have, who we think of when we think of our women leaders, they're the exception. They're not the norm, and yet they're being portrayed as being the norm, and therefore because this one person here managed to do it, then therefore everyone else should be able to do it just anyway because...
And we liked parading the fact that we've had two female prime ministers, we had a chief justice who was a female, we had the Speaker of the House was a female, and there was some other person who was a female. We had about four people all at the same time in these top jobs, and we made it as a country. What rubbish. That lasted for just, I did the calculate, it lasted for only 17 months, and I'm afraid we can't dine on that out on that either anymore.
Angela, we're just going to have our final song, though, and we'll get back into this fascinating discussion. And this is your choice, the Eurythmics.
Oh, great. Now, I grew up on the Eurythmics, and, because I for my sins, grew up through the 1980s. You know, they were the formative years when I was a teenager and leaving school and home and going to university. And one of the really interesting things is that the reason that I got through those years is because I had sisters, and I had sisters at home and sisters in, as in my good girlfriends. And this is why I like this song, because it's part of that part of growing up and finding out that actually I am able to advocate on behalf of women, and this is why it's a good song for me.
To be a great woman, but I'm in these times.
We're speaking about women in the workplace. And just in this final segment, there's a few things I'd like to touch on, one of which is policies that companies can put in place around family violence. And we've heard about this such a big issue in New Zealand and the ways in which businesses can take a role in this space.
It's just so prevalent. We lead the developed world virtually on violence against women's stats. It's appalling. And it's so prevalent. Employees have got to assume that there are employees who are victims of family violence and they are bringing that experience with them to work. They are probably disengaged from work. They're probably not as productive as they could be. And ultimately, the business is paying for that loss of productivity. They are in a perfect position to create a policy to help support those victims. And I just think it's a no-brainer of a policy. We only have two companies that do have such a policy publicly. That is The Warehouse and our spy agency, GCSB, though I do know there are many other corporates who are not far away from having their policies done, but this can't happen soon enough.
Right. And there's been a lot of work done too. Suzanne Snively and the PSA have done a lot of work around the cost of violence against women in the workplace. And there's also a piece of legislation, it's not a legislation, it's actually a bill waiting for the little biscuit tin for the drawer, around kind of legislating that sort of behaviour from businesses, that businesses can provide for support for victims of violence. So, it is a no-brainer, and it's just really sad that we have such an appalling rate, and can't wait to see some more businesses come on board.
So it's very difficult for women, and I specifically say women because the majority of protection orders that we still do are all for women, and it is still very much a gender issue, is trying to get the time off work to be able to come in and either see a lawyer or speak with a refuge worker to be able to gain support. I mean, many people still think of the refuge movement as being a safe house when actually the services they provide are so much beyond that in terms of advocacy and also counselling and family violence awareness. So being able to ensure that your employee is able to be connected into a refuge and also to be able to obtain legal advice, which they often need to do during work hours. They might need to attend court, in which case that's obviously always during work hours. It's incredibly difficult for employees who are not in management roles where they don't have the flexibility to be able to job and change and fit their hours around their work to be able to come in and see to get those protection orders in place, which are often vital to be able to provide that space for victims of violence to be able to have that security of their home environment through an occupation order, or the barrier that the protection order puts in place for them to be able to heal from that violence. And we love the work that we do with the refuges because of the amazing change that you see once there's been that space between the person that comes in and their first appointment, who is often so under so much strain, and where they are in 6 months' time with a new lease on life and so much vibrancy and energy.
I'm so impressed with what Evelyn Law does in working with women who are victims of violence, but a family violence policy in the workplace would cover that. Like the standard one that's used in Australia and businesses are using in New Zealand is that allows up to 10 days annually for leave to attend important appointments. It could be taken half a day here or a block of time there or whatever, but over the course of year. And just hearing you say how important it is for women to go through, be able to get to, get legal advice, get away from work, to do those appointments, and how it can change lives. I'm just so, you know, it's just so important that business gets behind this.
I'd also challenge employers to actually contribute towards the cost of the legal fees, for that matter too, because while we have legal aid available, and obviously that's, and there's no repayments required on legal aid for doing a protection order, it's if people meet the income threshold, there's still that gap as well between people who can't afford legal fees but are also not eligible for legal aid. And if employers mean it when they say that they're going to support their employees through family violence, potentially even helping with that crisis period with financially for legal fees would go a long way towards supporting their staff.
The other topic I'd like to just raise before we finish up is the idea of policies around maternity, paternity, parental leave, and how that can empower women in the workplace as well.
Well, these at the moment, we have 18 weeks of paid parental leave. We're not at 6 months, and that's obviously the ideal, and I'm sure that will come in time. What we would like to see at the Commission is that men have their own parental leave of their own. At the moment, it can be shared between the primary caregiver and the partner, but there's no separate entitlement for men. Men need to step up in their caring responsibilities, and I think that's a crucial part that needs to happen.
And I think it's about that language that you just highlighted too. If we really focus on the fact that it's parental leave, and look at the examples like I mentioned before about Norway, where you know the men have compulsory parental leave, that it's a shared responsibility. And you know, there's some great stuff being done by the businesses around that. So, you know, I know, for example, Coca-Cola, you know, they're a signatory to the Women's Empowerment Principles, and they've got a great system where, you know, they're whoever, and of course, at the moment, it's majority women that go on parental leave. You know, they have a support system for them. They're able to carry on having discussions, you know, with their workmates, and they can come along and be involved in you know, bits and pieces. ANZ have got a system where they carry on contributing to KiwiSaver. You know, so there's some great work being done, and I think this is the great thing about the Women's Empowerment Principles too, with the signatories, is that they're able to share this and you know, learn from each other, and there's some real really good things going on that we can all learn from each other and take on board.
And the strategy document the WEPS has produced is a blueprint, is giving all those practical steps of what you can do as a business, and it takes the businesses through it so it's achievable and it's not overwhelming. So we want all businesses to sign up to Women's Empowerment Principles.
That sounds like a perfect place to finish up. And have you got any final comments before we say kia ora?
Thank you.
I just want to say kia ora. Thank you.
It's been a great discussion. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, Sally. Thank you for organising it.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. And check out our Facebook page. People will be putting up some of these comments that people have been mentioning here.
Oh, great.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.